and good afternoon. Scott Spears back with you here on this Tuesday, August 21st, 2018. 13 minutes past the hour, and we're going back to the trivia questions here. Remember, we've got tickets to Zumbeezy Bay. We've got tickets to Kosai. We've got tickets to Tecumseh. We've got tickets to the Wild, Jack Hanna's Wilds. We've got all kinds of stuff to give away here, and a Huntsman Auto Oil Change, 5 quarts of non-synthetic oil for automobiles only. Now, here are the trivia questions that we have on the table. Madge Cooper taught at 2 schools before she came to the radio business. We know one is LaRue. What was the other school that Madge Cooper taught at? 740-383-9944. Who called, what judge called Charlie Evers after Charlie went on the air and somebody wanted Charlie to look for Lady Justice? Charlie got a call off the air from a judge saying, don't mention that again on the air, because he was afraid that Lady Justice would be destroyed. Who was the judge that called Charlie Evers off the air? 740-383-9944. Another Charlie Evers question here. After he left WMRN in 1995, he had 2 other professions other than radio. Now, one we already have, working at the Convention and Visitors Bureau, but what was Charlie's other profession that he did after he left WMRN in 1995? 740-383-9944. Those are the questions on the table. Let's see here if we have any other interesting questions that we can give you today. Oh, here's one. Well, we'll take the call, then we'll go back to that. Okay. Go ahead, caller.
Well, Charlie ran a store over in Mansfield. I can't remember exactly what he had in there. I know he had some, like, fire alarms and different things like that.
That would have been like prior to 95.
I can't think of the name of the store he had.
You know, I don't know what the name of it was.
One of the things that he did.
That was prior, though, to 1995.
Oh, they were prior?
Yeah, that was prior. The store was prior.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. But he did 2 things after he left WMRN.
All right.
Okay. Thanks. The question is, what did Charlie Evers do? He had 2 professions other than radio after he left WMRN in 1995. Now, one of them was the Convention and Visitors Bureau. He worked there, but we don't know what the other one is. 740-383-9944. What is the other profession that he had? Here's another question for you. Our former mayor of Marion, longest-serving mayor in Marion history, Jack Kellogg, we'll come back to that question momentarily as well. Go ahead, caller.
I know what it was. He was a tour guide.
Well, that's what he did for the Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Oh, okay.
But he had another one. Keep trying.
All right.
Okay. Yep, he did tours for the Convention and Visitors Bureau, but there was another profession that he had. 740-383-9944. What 2 schools did Madge Cooper teach at before she came to radio? She taught in LaRue. What was the other school? 740-383-9944. Okay. The judge. What judge called Charlie Evers off the air after the discussion about trying to find Lady Justice started? This judge called Charlie off the air and said, don't ask that question on the air again because they'll destroy Lady Justice. What judge gave Charlie Evers that warning? 740-383-9944. The longest-serving mayor in Marion history, Jack Kellogg, collects 2 items. Now, if you listen to the station regularly, you should know what one of those is. What does Jack Kellogg collect? He collects 2 items. two particular, I guess, theme items. Now, one you hear on the station quite a bit, but he collects two. What do you think Jack Kellogg collects? Two different types of items. 740-383-9944. Okay. Let's see here. What other question could we ask? Okay, here's one for you. Mary Ellen Withrow. Who swore Mary Ellen Withrow in as Treasurer of the United States? Do you know who swore her in? 740-383-9944. Who swore Mary Ellen Withrow in as Treasurer of the United States? 740-383-9944. So those are our new questions today. Name the two places that Madge Cooper taught before she came to radio. One was LaRue. What's the other one? 740-383-9944. Charlie Evers had two professions after he left WMRN in 1995. One was working at the Convention and Visitors Bureau, but he did something else. Where else did he work? 740-383-9944. Who swore Mary Ellen Withrow in? Go ahead, caller.
Did Madge teach at the Silver Street School?
Not Silver Street, but that's a good guess.
Okay, goodbye.
Thank you. Nope, not Silver Street. What two schools did Madge Cooper teach at before she came to radio? One was LaRue. What was the other one? 740-383-9944. What judge told Charlie Evers not to look for Lady Justice because he was fearful that it would be destroyed? Who was the judge who told Charlie not to mention it? 740-383-9944. After Charlie Evers left WMRN in 1995, he's had two professions. One was the Convention and Visitors Bureau. What was the other one? Go ahead, caller.
It's about the statue. Is it Judge McDaniels?
McDaniels. Oh, no, not McDaniels. No. But thank you. Thank you. Not Judge McDaniels. Who was the judge who gave Charlie Evers the warning to not ask about Lady Justice anymore on the air after somebody called in and asked Charlie to help find it? Who was the judge who called Charlie off the air and said, don't look for it because it might get destroyed? Who was that? 740-383-9944. Who swore in Mary Ellen Withrow as the Treasurer of the United States? Who swore Mary Ellen Withrow in when she was made Treasurer of the United States? The longest-serving mayor in Marion history, Jack Kellogg, collects two items. What does he collect? 740-383-9944. Go ahead, caller.
It wasn't Quaintance, was it?
The judge?
Yeah.
Nope, not Judge Quaintance.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye. No, I don't know if we had a judge. We had a mayor Quaintance, but I'm not sure if we had a judge Quaintance. What judge called Charlie off the air and said, don't mention Lady Justice anymore. We don't want it to get destroyed. 740-383-9944. Go ahead, caller.
Was it Judge Rizzo?
Not Judge Rizzo.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Nope, not Judge Rizzo. Interesting question. What judge called Charlie before he started to look for Lady Justice? Well, I guess it had already been put in motion. Somebody called in and had asked the question. You know what? We're actually going to do something here. Hold on just one second. I think we are going to make a transition here momentarily and maybe learn a little more about President Harding, which we had a lot of fun doing last week. So I'll save these trivia questions maybe for tomorrow, and we'll learn a little more now about Florence Harding like we were doing last week and having a lot of fun doing that, as one of the callers said earlier. So momentarily, I think we're going to be joined here by a guest. So stick with us. We're going to take a quick come back very shortly. Don't you dare go anywhere.
Hi, this is Steve Boom Boom Cannon, and as the king of trivia, I've got a question for you. Where can you find great talk, open phone lines, and celebrities every day? Now with Scott Spears on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM LP. We're in Marion, Ohio. Call him at 740-383-9944. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com.
From 1210 to 2 p.m. Monday through Friday.
This is Marianne Michaels, and you can catch my friend Scott Spears Monday through Friday right here on WWGH 107.1 FM. Streaming live on the internet at WWGH1071.com. Entertaining interviews with celebrities and local topics every day.
Live 1210 to 2 p.m.
Hello, this is Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and you know, Charlie Evers is a Marion radio legend, and right here on WWGH 107.1 FM and streaming live on the internet at WWGH1071.com. Charlie also takes your calls on anything under the sun by 740-383-9944. Speedy delivery.
The Fahey Bank Charlie Evers Show every Wednesday and Thursday, 10:10 a.m. till 12 noon, and Friday, 1:10 p.m. till 3 p.m. on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. It's Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, right here on WWGH Radio from 12:10 to 2 p.m. Listen to the program for guests like these. The voice of Ursula from The Little Mermaid and actress Pat Carroll.
And I think villains are the most fascinating people as an actress to play. They have more edges to them. They have more color to them. Isn't that a shame that goodness isn't more fascinating, or our world would be better?
I guess.
But there is something fascinated about tacky people, mean people. They're colorful. Good people always seem to be a little bit, yucky. But bad people always have edges to them. That's why they're so wonderful to play for actors.
That?
Because you can pick all the things in life as a human being that annoy you or that you would like to do to be really rotten mean. Most people are too afraid to be rotten mean because we want people's approval so badly. And we know that being rotten mean isn't going to get us that. But, oh, villains for actors are the best things in the world to play.
You know, Pat, that almost describes our current political situation in this country.
Doesn't it just? I'd never thought of that, but you're quite right.
Join me Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio. We'll take your calls, 740-383-9944, streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. All right, Scott Spears back with you here on this Tuesday, August the 21st, 2018, 26 minutes coming up on 27 minutes past the hour. And last week we had a fascinating visit with the gentleman who has written the definitive biography on Florence Harding. The book is Florence Harding, The First Lady, The Jazz Age, and The Death of America's Most Scandalous President. I am so glad to welcome back to these microphones for 35 minutes today, because we just scratched the surface last week of this great book, author Carl Anthony. Carl, how are you?
Very good, Scott, and very appreciative again of your patience. It's just such a busy time for me, and I've got to keep my eye on things, you know, and so I appreciate your flexibility.
No, I tell you, we here in Marion are so interested in Florence Harding. And when we talked last week, we left off talking about how there would not have been a Warren Harding had there not been a Florence Harding. Kind of elaborate more on that.
Well, I think he was competent, much more competent than many have credited him for. I think he may have sometimes used the classic sort of self-deprecation sometimes, you know, about himself that a lot of politicians use. But what I'm not sure he had all the time was confidence. And I'm not even sure if it was a lack of confidence as much as perhaps excessive humility. What I mean by that is not wanting to, I think to Harding a certain degree of modesty, personal modesty. Now that might seem odd saying that about a person who seeks and achieves, you know, the lieutenant governorship and the United States Senate and the presidency, but that's where I think Florence came in. I think Florence could quell some of his very private self-doubt and hesitation to put himself forward as the right man for the job. And I don't believe it was blind love or loyalty, because I think she worked so closely with him on a daily basis at the newspaper. And although we know her most well as having been the business manager of the paper, she had also worked sometimes at editing. She was a very good writer and a very good editor. I might add, she is, to my knowledge, the first lady to have written just a little squib in a national publication. It was a Ladies' Home Journal or something like that. It was a little sort of statement on the 4th of July. But in going through her papers, I could see what a good writer she was. And also, I would add, you know, during her widowhood, she did consider writing a biography of her husband based on the papers that she had been going through. But at the newspaper, she read his editorials, and she read his original writing. And I think she thought he had just the perfect blend of humility and capability to lead the country. And I think that's where she helped to convince him that he was the right person. On a very emotional, personal basis, I think, you know, I don't think she ever stopped wishing that he would love her with the great degree that she loved him, and that perhaps in seeing how indispensable she had become in his life, that perhaps in helping him achieve the pinnacle of political success, that perhaps he would by that time grow in terms of you know, the degree of love that he did have for her, that it would sort of be commensurate with hers towards him.
Carl, two things, a lot of things. 1919 and 1920 are very interesting years for the Hardings. There's a lot going on. He's running for president. He's had a child with another woman, which we think he is aware of, so he's having this affair. He's also having an affair with Carrie Phillips back here in Marion. The Republican national chair sends Carrie Phillips on a trip around the world. We think Harding obviously knows about this, to keep her quiet, and offers to pay her the rest of his life, or her life. How involved is Florence in the campaign? Does she know these payoffs and things are going on? At one point, she lied and said that she was widowed from her first marriage.
Correct.
And she was not. And also, President Harding's father is out kind of saying things that aren't true, that he's going to be the first to see his son inaugurated. So a lot going on. How involved was she?
Well, on Dr. Harding, I would probably forgive him only in that, you know, sometimes you read even in the New York Times, the so-called paper of record for the country, that sometimes there's a gap in information, and he may not have known, you know, that he was not going to be the first father to see his son become president. I think, you know, Florence was terrified of, at least according to the manuscript we have written by Kathleen Lawler, who served as her secretary during the presidential campaign, that Mrs. Harding was terrified of people finding out about her child and relationship, first relationship. So, you know, I don't want to say one justifies lying in the campaign, but it was never made into a very big issue. Although, of course, we have on record the fact that the Democratic vice presidential candidate, Franklin D. Roosevelt, did know about it. And he, in a private letter, said that the Democrats would be holding that as potentially harmful information if the Republicans made public the fact that their candidate, James Cox, had an affair or was having an affair. Oh, gosh, it seems everyone was having an affair. But she always had a really strong sense of contemporary media. She was very interested. I think of Michelle Obama, having really been current with technology, with not just social media, but online, you know, music and downloading. And over her 8 years, she made many references to it and was kept up to date. She had her own Spotify list of music. Hillary and Barbara Bush, also Barbara Bush, to my knowledge, the first first lady to own her own laptop computer. Hillary, of course, the internet first lady. Florence had a radio brought into the White House, the first radio. Florence was fascinated about the entire, I should mention, President Harding, fascinated by the what they called then the moving picture industry, you know, movies, which were relatively new, and of course predate just a few years, unfortunately, talkies or sound recordings, because we still do not know, we do not believe there's any recording of Florence's voice. But she was interested in flying. You know, she was the first lady, although she was technically the wife of the president-elect, to fly in an airplane. Harding was a little afraid to do that, but not Florence. We know she loved cars and was so she was very up on technology of that era, and I think she recognized the potential for the use of the media in the campaign. I think she understood from her devoted mission to the disabled and wounded veterans at Walter Reed Hospital, she understood a very important emotional issue that was policy related that year that perhaps was the most important political issue of the 1920 campaign, and that was America's obligation to any further and future overseas conflicts. And so she was vehemently opposed to the League of Nations. And, you know, so many American families had, you know, farm families in Kansas had their sons, you know, their 18 and 19 year old sons plucked and sent off to foreign countries, and they returned home with, as the French called it, broken faces because of the new kinds of warfare. You know, young men would forever have breathing problems and have to move out to the West where their lung capacity had a better chance because of mustard gas. Florence knew all of this, and she understood the trauma of World War One. And, of course, in 1919, we're still talking about, you know, the armistice had been signed, but, you know, the League of Nations is being debated and is eventually defeated. And so that was a very important issue. That was an important issue in the campaign that I think she and her role in that has been overlooked. She also was, by nature, a feminist. So interesting, when we really look at those first ladies who were genuine feminists, you know, we had this stereotype on our mind of what a feminist is, and back in her day, believe me, that image was even more sarcastic and bitter because it was in the form of the suffragist. So it was usually the most physically repulsive cartoons possibly drawn of women, you know, and it was all such of awful things said about why women, why would a housewife or a mother, you know, was usually portrayed as very beautiful, you know, why would she be interested in having the vote or being interested in anything to do with civic life? It was really awful. And Florence, always, because of her own story, was very much a feminist and a suffragist. And she even declared, yes, I am a suffragist. And so that issue, and of course, it was sort of a foregone conclusion at the beginning of the summer of 1920. But she got on the bandwagon early. Now, Harding, of course, had really resisted for a long time, you know, support for suffrage, women's suffrage, the 19th Amendment giving women the right to vote, which, you know, finally passed it with two states doing so in the summer of 1920, and then it was ratified, you know, part of the Constitution, so women across the country were able to vote for Harding. And she really emphasized this fact, and she met with women's groups that were not only kind of traditional in nature, but the new political women's groups, and not just the partisan one, like the Women's National Republican Committee, but the League of Women Voters. So those are just, frankly, in a quick way, and I know, realize I'm very wordy there, but those are some of the ways in which Florence Harding had a significant role during the 1920 presidential campaign.
Did she know about the payoffs that were going to Carrie Phillips?
Based on the very big letter that Judge Charlton Meyer had given me the transcript for, which is a very key of all the letters between the Harding and Carrie, and I believe that was he had that, or at least get a copy of it, because I've not in the letters that have been released since then, the Harding letters to Phillips, I don't remember seeing that one, but he was very, very detailed. It was the one in which he really, it's written in the winter of 1920, and it's the one in which he really, you know, bargains with Carrie, and he mentions Florence, not by name. He said something like, the other party is aware, and something suggesting like she is unhappy with everything, but she has agreed to the arrangement. So
to me, that would suggest it. I have to, you know, I can't quote it verbatim. The book, it was, you know, 20 years ago I wrote it, but it's in there. And so that would suggest that she did. Now, what we also know from Evelyn McLean's interviews with her ghostwriter of her autobiography, a man by the name of Boyden Sparks, it was Jess Smith, who did not ever have an official position in the campaign, but was basically the right-hand man and companion of the campaign manager, Harry Doherty. And it's according to Evelyn, it was Jess Smith who privately arranged for the collection of funds from several wealthy donors to the RNC, Republican National Committee, and then it was through him that the payments were made, and not any official of the Republican National Committee.
You know, it's very interesting because Harding always ranks at the bottom of presidential lists, and the knock on him is he was asleep at the wheel, Teapot Dome. Was Florence aware of this Teapot Dome scandal when he's delegating away all this power? Is she aware of it? Because she seems like a savvy person.
Well, you know, the transfer of the national oil reserves, it's a rather complicated scandal, and in other ways a rather simple one, but it was public knowledge that the it was, you know, written about, and there was seemingly nothing illegal with the transfer of control of these naval oil reserves from the Navy Department to the Interior Department. The thinking being, well, we were no longer at war, and it was not something that, you know, the Navy needed to have direct control over, and that the Interior Department should. So Albert Falls, the Secretary of Interior, was the one who sought President Harding's approval for that and gained it. And there was on that in that decision seemingly nothing wrong. It was the secret leasing of the oil reserves, and of course the payoffs, the kickbacks that Albert Fall received, which were illegal. And of course Fall later claimed that, oh no no, these were loans that were made by Harry Sinclair of Sinclair Oil and Edward Doheny of Doheny Oil. And there was a couple of times when Florence, I know in the memoirs of Charles Forbes, who created actually a worse scandal and a more emotionally painful one to both Florence and Warren, and one in which they were both tied to sustain the full shock of, but Mrs. Harding went to Forbes one afternoon and just very, and they were very friendly, extremely friendly, and she and Forbes, and Forbes owed his job to her. So she had insisted he be named head of the new Veterans Bureau, the newly formed government agency called the Veterans Bureau, and that was because, you know, she supported that because of all the, you know, because of her concern for the veterans. But anyway, he came to him one day. They were, I think, on the South Portico or in the Oval Room, and she said, just came up to him very boldly and said, "What do you know about Harry Sinclair, who's the oil man?" And he said, "Well, I know who he is, but I don't know anything about him." And then she dropped the subject. So now he does not particularly, he does not date when she said that, and that's an important factor, of course. But, you know, so there is the perhaps suggestion in that, and again, I used two qualifying words, perhaps and suggest. What, you know, it's a far stretch from saying she knew. What the worst scandal was what occurred at the Veterans Bureau. And that was a scandal of enormous proportions, and it was not just one nefarious act, but many, in which Charles Forbes, her close friend, Charlie, had
was receiving an enormous amount of money, kickbacks, payoffs, and selling U.S. government supplies that were in storage to be used on behalf of the veterans. There were supposed to be veteran hospitals built around the country, and he was supposed to be getting sealed bids, and instead, of course, making deals with the people who won the bids, the build, you know, the construction companies. And Mrs. Harding started to get letters from nurses who were working in the Veterans Hospital talking about abuse towards them, sexual harassment and abuse. And Mrs. Harding was very upset about this and immediately wanted it investigated. And she not only went to ask Forbes about it, but she sent her doctor, Charles Sawyer, to look into it. Now, as I had said in our previous conversation, if anyone to me has done great damage to the Hardings, it was Charles Sawyer and his son, Carl Sawyer. Their sense of ownership and possessiveness of the Hardings and the Harding legacy was so tightly controlled and so jealously guarded that it prevented any honest, even-handed discussion of President Harding. And they prevented access, well, the son prevented access to the Harding papers for those crucial first decades after President Harding's death. And that really is what I believe was the greatest damage done. But Sawyer, perhaps you want to say, redeems himself. In his jealousness of the Hardings, he never liked Charlie Forbes because of how close Forbes was to Florence. So any chance he had to show up Forbes, he seized upon. And in this case, it was Dr. Sawyer making an unannounced visit to some of the warehouses of the Veterans Bureau in Maryland, not far from Washington, on a day trip, that he was able to report what was going on. And that was the beginning of the end for Forbes. And it resulted in a rather famous scene in which President Harding was claimed to have been, Harding was not a man given to anger or violence, but he was so enraged, he was seen shaking Charlie Forbes by the neck against the wall in the Red Room. And, you know, it was not just a, stealing of funds and not just a huge scandal that was starting to break during Harding's life, but it was a betrayal of, you know, tens of thousands of these young men who had, you know, sacrificed, not just willing to sacrifice their lives, but ended up sacrificing their physical and emotional well-being forever. And that was a betrayal. And Florence even said that was the one betrayal she and the president never recovered from.
You know, it's very interesting because there are a lot of comparisons between Warren Harding and Florence Harding and Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt and Bill and Hillary Clinton. Now, the interesting thing is Harding was obviously carrying out his affairs while he was president, and so was Franklin Roosevelt. Bill Clinton, we know he did something, but we don't know if he was carrying out his affairs while he was president. But certainly Franklin Roosevelt was. And at the end, Eleanor, I mean, he died with his mistress, so she really didn't have much left for him. This is going on while he's president. Certainly Nan Britton is. It's going on in cloakrooms at the White House. Is she aware of that?
Well, as we discussed last time, the incident that was put on the record by her then still alive Secret Service agent Harry Barker, that he had heard from another Secret Service agent that a young woman, apparently Britton, had been meeting with the president, and Barker then, loyal to the First Lady, tipped her off, and the incident occurred where she came down from the residence and made her way over to the Oval Office and was denied entrance. Now, again, it's a little bit of, you know, we don't know the timing exactly of what happened, but that is one incident. We also know from the full and but unpublished manuscript of Evelyn McLean, which is in her papers, and also those transcripts that exist of their tape conversations with her ghostwriter, that during a trip to Florida in the summer of the winter of 21, or was it 22? I can't recall. But no, it was 22. That, you know, Mrs. Harding knew that the president was out, you know, with women. Now, again, let's also be a little bit careful here and say that we speak of affairs. Yes, we can say, obviously, in the case of both Phillips and Britain, based on various evidences that we have only in recent years had, there was a physical relationship. But, you know, as Jacqueline Kennedy and Eleanor Roosevelt, and I don't know about what Hillary Clinton's thoughts were on it, but, you know, sometimes some of these spouses of very powerful men have learned to look the other way, as long as what was going on was not an emotional, if you will, threat to them, meaning that their husbands were not, you know, in love with these women, or that, you know, and so the other thing is, you know, if somebody is out having a drink and flirting with these women, and maybe a few hugs and kisses, you know, that's that. There's a great distance between that and a overtly, you know, is a physically intimate relationship. Now, others would say there is no difference, but you know, the degree to which all of these occurred with President Harding, we have various evidences or you know, statements to the different degrees of what those relationships were like. So, to what degree Mrs. Harding herself was upset about some of these things, you know, that may also explain why sometimes, while she might have been agitated, I often, as Evelyn McLean said, and I think Evelyn McLean really is the most honest and fair voice on Mrs. Harding, because I think she truly loved her, but yet, as a genuine friend, she also saw, you know, her attributes as well as her deficiencies, and she felt that Mrs. Harding was more concerned about what the appearance of this would be giving out to the public if they saw him or they learned of it, and less about the effect on her personally.
Well, that's the interesting thing. I broached that subject again today because there's, you know, this scene that everybody has after President Harding dies. Florence is burning papers, allegedly. What is her biggest fear? When the president dies, what is she trying to avoid?
Well, she wanted his memory to be preserved in a good way, and she felt an absolute sense of loyalty to him, much as Jacqueline Kennedy did, much as Nancy Reagan did. Even Lady Bert Johnson, who took a different tact, which was let the truth come out, because Lyndon was enough of a good person and did enough good things for so many people that any personal shortcomings would have to be understood in the context of the good things he did for the public. And that's rare. I think Eleanor Roosevelt may have had that attitude as well. But Usually, you know, the spouses are seeking to you may ensure that the most saintly impression is cast of these men in the years immediately following their death, which is when most of the books are written and the, you know, the articles are written and so forth. And then that becomes the primary body of literature of secondary sources that everyone would be going to. So I think that that is really was her concern. I think in going through the papers, and we know that she did because it's also, it's in many different sources. It's not just in Evelyn McLean's recollections, but also Kathleen Lawler's, you know, it's even suggestive, of course, in news reports at the time. And so we don't know that she was looking for any one particular thing, but we know, but I think she was just sort of like, didn't have an idea what might turn up. And that was part of the whole purpose of going through things. You know, anything that I think that the remark was made to Reddy Baldinger, her aide, who was interviewed in the late 1950s, I believe it was, we've basically, I'm paraphrasing, I'm not quoting, something along the lines of, you know, we've got to do whatever we have to do to make sure that, you know, Warren's memory, Warren is remembered well. And from what Evelyn McLean said, it was an overwhelming task, and that perhaps more things were destroyed than needed to be. And of course, you know, we were talking about August. It was in Washington, D.C. It was outside that they did this at Evelyn McLean's mansion, Friendship. You know, there were just these bonfires. There was at one point, it was sort of firing that entire a suitcase full of papers were just simply tossed onto the flames. So I'm not even so sure that, you know, Mrs. Harding necessarily knew all that she was destroying. But it really was overwhelming. And you think about that as well as the fact that she's also has grief. And so, you know, and was in a certain degree, perhaps shock. So, you know, in cutting some slack to her, I think, it's been suggested that she knew exactly what, she didn't know exactly what was, you know, in his, papers. And so, I think that was, you know, that was part of what was going on there.
Carl, before we part ways here, and again, I want to let the audience know the book is Florence Harding, The First Lady, The Jazz Age, and The Death of America's Most Scandalous President. Carl Anthony is the author. In this book, what to you is the most interesting thing to know about Florence Harding that maybe the listeners right now don't know?
That she had foresight. That she was a leader, that she had a blend of toughness and formidability, and was a very, could be a very austere and frightening figure, and yet warmth, compassion, rugged integrity, honesty. When she said she was going to do something, she did it. And she was a person of fairness. And, you know, they talked about Main Street coming, you know, to the White House. They talked about small town values. You know, you could try and say that, but the truth is, it was her as an individual, regardless of where she was from, regardless of what her marriage was like. You know, one of the most moving things I found was a very tough letter she wrote to a Florida Republican committee woman who was complaining about an African-American being appointed to a political position. And Mrs. Harding responded politely but firmly, if this is the kind of letter you expect to send to the president, I will not be the person to pass it on to him. If you know, she didn't attack the woman, but she said, I will not participate in allowing this to go forward. And she really, and you know, again, we're right after the Wilsons, who were very overtly bigoted, Woodrow and Edith Wilson, and you know, on so many things, Mrs. Harding, she and the president saw the value of film for education. She really believed in the equality of women. She really believed in the humanity of beings who happen not to be humans, meaning animals, and that they deserved dignity and respect. You know, she lived by values that I would say that are very contemporary and progressive even today.
It's very interesting. The book is Florence Harding. The author is Carl Anthony. Carl, thank you so much. You are always welcome on this program. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Bye-bye. And we're done for the day. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout. Stay tuned. More programming. The first part of the Carl Anthony interview will replay in about 10 minutes.
4-4. Join them.
This is Patty Worcester with Marion Midget Football.